This is a production of Cornell University.
Student Assembly Meeting, April
7th, 2011. The time is 4:47. I'm calling the April 7th Student Assembly Meeting to order. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Here.
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 Late. 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 Late.
Here. 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 Late.
Here.
Unexcused.
He's not coming.
He's unexcused. She's here.
Yes. Yep.
Here. The guard's here.
All right. Approval of the minutes from March 31st, 2011. Those were sent out. Are there any amendments to the minutes? Seeing none, I'm going to move for acclamation. Is there any dissent? Seeing none, the minutes from March 31st are approved. Your own.
Yes, yes.
Open microphone.
If we have any members of the audience who would like to talk on an issue not currently on the agenda for today, please feel free to come up to the open microphone table. Seeing no one, I'm going to move to close the open microphone and move on with the agenda for today.
All right, announcements and reports. Arts, Ethan Beats. By Representative Smith. All right, thank you. Next on the agenda, SUNY SA, EVP Mensa.
Okay, so tomorrow, Representative Matt Danzer and I will be traveling to Syracuse for the SUNY SA conference. And, you know, so basically I'm just putting it out there, you know, if any of you has any issues, have any issues that you would like us to bring to the SUNY SA, just email us. And, you know, we'll make sure that they're heard over the weekend.
Any questions? All right. I also have a report. On Friday, I met with President Gordon as we do twice a semester, with some other student leaders. We spoke about the issue of transparency in the university decision-making process, and during the meeting, President Gordon committed himself to creating a standing group, along with the provost was there as well. In this standing group, essentially, he'd be using it to it'd be a standing group of students, which would probably be the leaders of this assembly, GPSA, UA, all the representative constituency groups, and the president would be using the standing committee to both vet as well as run the decisions, options, that the university is currently thinking of going through before it's announced, and supposedly also before the decision is final, to try and increase the amount of student input that goes into the decision-making process. And so this commitment to creating the standing committee came about largely from student trustee Derek Evanson and myself just pressuring and urging the administration to create some type of pipeline standing committee. So the president committed himself to creating that committee, and hopefully it will come into effect at the start of next year with the new elected officers. So, though, yeah. And so it's what we settled upon was decisions that were going to affect students and constituent groups that are going to be presented on, you know, on the committee. That's a pretty vague statement, but currently we don't have the agreement in writing either, but I'm just here to, I think he will follow through with his commitment. And any increase in engagement, I think, is a good thing. And hopefully next year's essay can pressure him to use that standing committee as much as possible, especially if it's there and a decision which does affect students wasn't run through the committee. It's very easy to tell students, well, you know, we even have this working group and that decision wasn't presented to us. On the other hand, if that committee is in place, the representatives better use that committee for their, you know, to their advantage and engage the administration as much as possible. But that should be in the works for next year. Are there any other questions? Seeing none, we'll move to business of the day, Resolution 74, Cornell Cinema ticket price increase approvals. So the Student Advisory Board got printed a few different times. It's the first thing there. It's also behind Resolution 69. And it's also behind Resolution 74, so you should have it about three times in your packet. Mm-hmm.
Really?
Yeah, I think so. But that's for the Student Advisory Board. But we're currently doing Resolution 74, Cornell Cinema ticket price increase approval. And sponsors of the resolution have 4 minutes. Please.
Matt is coming on here to give the cinema liaison for the first time. Terrific job in the last 2 semesters in improving community membership. And I'm hoping this dialogue, you know, again, I want to thank Mary Tyler as well for having dialogue with us throughout the year. So, you know, as a kind of backdrop to the increased communication we've had this year, and I'm continuing our discussion we had at the end of last academic year, basically the cinema coming to us today to ask that we increase the undergraduate or recruit increase the undergraduate price and from $4 to $4.50, and the FAA requests this approval through a community guideline for Cornell Cinema, which states that Cornell Cinema should not increase student ticket prices without the express approval of the student. To protect against ticket price increases, the FAA has a large chunk of funding for so the document is in fact the resolution, and that's what we're going to amend that provides us to make our decision. But We expect our Mr. Grant to drop the new custom in the New York State Legislature. And if you do not hear the difference in the state legislature, it's like a different announcement between the NSA and the GDSA. We will receive a $50,000 to reapply to the GDSA for the last 20 projects for a 2013.
All right, thank you. First on the speaker's list is E.V. Pimenta.
Thank you for that. I appreciate what you said. You know, I just have two questions. You know, one is, I do understand where you're at right now, where you're coming from. But, I guess I'm curious to know if there are other things you can do, cut some shows out, that would not make this increase unnecessary. And then, I'm a bit concerned, it's a good price now, obviously some things change, and, just don't want, things to occur where this becomes so regular, that the price keeps going up, So in addition to that, I guess, if things are not as bad as they are now, and if things are more under control, would the cinema be open to bringing prices back down, or, so
I guess so.
Representative Smith. We got him before. We have a lot of speakers.
So they're going to actually get it. And I think it's a pretty good decision. Sure, it's about
You have 30 seconds.
I just want to offer a framework for how to kind of look at this issue. Obviously, Cornell is doing a decision to have a pretty substantial budget. And so I think that we should just obviously allow them to manage great resources. And what we should be considering now is which why this decision exists. Is this by an abuse of their kind of ability to create this crisis? Is it going to create a lot of unnecessary trouble with students? And obviously, just keeping into account that we don't want to micromanage, we just want to protect students from ticket prices and increases that are only
20 cents.
30 seconds. Think of it as a subsidy organization, and seeing as we remove part of the subsidy to Cornell Cinema, there is a gap in what they have, and so it's only right to allow them to fill in that gap as one subsidy with an increase in their own revenue.
Next on the speaker's list is Representative Kerr. Next is Representative Desai.
Yes, I found just to go right off of what Representative Desai said. Like, I think we should be looking at whether or not under the jurisdiction of how we fund the SAF, this is something that we should be allowing organizations to do. For those of you guys, well, I know a lot of people last year when we did look at the bottom funding application, a lot of people said that ticket prices should be increased, that we should be subsidizing individual students at that kind of a rate. A lot of people took contention with some of the very low attended screenings that had very high cost of them. So, in my own personal opinion, I think it's a little bit hypocritical to make all those statements last year and tell them that we want them to be more fiscally responsible and ask them to increase the price by 50 cents a week. I know that would be strongly recommended to pass this resolution.
All right, I'm going to jump in here really quickly. Is Cornell Cinema going to allow live performances to be put on at in the Cornell Cinema venue? Live stream performances. Yeah, I thought that last year there was also a discussion of perhaps using the cinema venue for one or two nights per semester or whatnot to allow students to put on live student programming for as in plays or whatnot. Is that an option that cinema is considering at all?
Well, basically we have a contract with the student consultant or the student leader, and so we'll build that contract in the building and maybe 9 months.
Okay. Yeah. All right. All right. Thank you. Next is Representative the Judge.
Just a few questions really quick. So you mentioned in the report for the presentation that you had the GSA actually stated that you might want to ask us to increase the price with the differential. How did they notify you of that?
I mean that came up from the
and then just continuing on the CSA or the CSA,
speaking to whoever goes to my line of office again, depending on what we're getting in realistic prices then, yeah, to the extent that we get the same amount of money in the retail thing, and okay, we would have to charge the same ticket price. I can't say for sure what that price would be, but it will be the same.
Has there been research done on how, I mean, you mentioned last time this was like $5 and then you start to lose. Has there been any research or any research to say today that it's going to be the same thing? That you're not going to lose revenue with that?
Next on the speaker's list is Representative Yazwick.
Yeah, I personally completely agree with what my friend Nicolai said. I think it's sort of like a bit like a business case, and I think Cornell Cinema, they may not be trying to have a product, but they're trying to provide a service to the students at Cornell University. And I completely trust that they know the best way to do that. And I don't think that if it's exactly an egregious number to be surprised by.
There's been a call to question. There's been a second. So there's been a dissent. We're going to vote to vote. If you're in favor of, you'll retract. All right. Next on the speaker's list is Representative Brockman. Call to question in a second. Is there any dissent? Seeing none, we will now go to a roll call vote. Will the clerk please call the roll?
Yes.
Yes.
Vote by unanimous decision, the ticket price goes up by 50 cents. I'm not going to clap about that. Okay. All right. Everyone pay for meeting. So moving on to simple approval of Cornell Cinema Student Advisory Board bylaws. So this is not necessarily a resolution. But in Appendix A, or in Appendix B, actually, According to the byline funding process, we do request that organizations create bylaws if they're going to receive student activity fee money. In accordance with that criteria for an organization to change and all that stuff, their bylaws, it is requested they just notify the SA. So in our discussions with students with Cornell Cinema, we just asked them to draft up a quick student advisory board bylaws, and here they are for our review and just quick discussion. So, Matt. Thank you, Taylor. Are there any questions? All right. Seeing none, thank you for creating the document. And if there are any more questions between the student assembly, and there's Matt Danzer is a resource. And so I'm just going to do a simple approval yes by voice vote. If you are in favor of the Student Advisory Board bylaws, please say yes.
Yes.
All those against, please say no. Seeing none, they're approved. Thank you. Thank you, Cornell Cinema, for coming today. All right. Are we going to some high school institutional connections?
That's what's next, unless he wants to change it. Yeah, but
all right. We are going to go to we'll do Resolution 70, calling for a constitutional convention.
Have a good evening.
student orientation, so they feel you know what their rights are, but like, what we want our students to have. So, you know, in the end, we plan to have both documents in resolution form for what they were. And it should be a lively discussion with lots of input from you guys and from community members. So, that's it. Any questions?
All right, I do have a few questions. One, do you have a list of people who've confirmed for the 21st?
Yeah, we're up to three. There's still some who haven't confirmed. That's okay, because we do have enough panel. Lisa Beeflin, she's on the Freedom Committee and a lot of professors. Ted Clarema from law school, also someone very involved in cancer of conduct. Ben Kappa, lawyer, Paul Sawyer, who's a legal professor, who studies protests. Lee Adler, who's at large school. The Associate of Western will come. Someone from the policy office will come. Still working on another judicial administrator, because you bear that plan. We'll be around that day. And I do have a meeting with my program to run that.
And for students, what type of advertising are you doing for students, and how many which attendance for students?
I'm at the recent public relations committee meeting where we went through a blur, and hopefully if you pass this, you can rely on funds from the reserve fund to print out more posters, and we'll have a radio group so we don't have any beats or whatever. As soon as this resolution passed, we're in full publicity mode.
And so, in short, you'd be taking the place of the 21st student assembly meeting for this and requesting $500 from the reserve account. All right. And just for the essay, I sent out an email of all the agenda items that we still have to get through the rest of the year. I sent it out around 4:30. But just for you all to know what the outlook is for the rest of the year. But are there any questions from essay members?
So I just want to point out that I've already cleared April 21st, you know, for this right here. So, you know, I guess the most important thing here, you know, in apart from publicity is the $500, you know, that,
And this would be a regularly scheduled lesson meeting, so you are required to attend all normal attendance policies. Yes, Representative Smith.
No, I think that's pretty good. I think it's a pretty good idea. Something more than I could vote for maybe but we said it all the time. And even if you're a lot of those months, even though we have the even though we have the problem, there's still a lot of black and white areas that come in there, and I think this is really gonna help. And even the conversations and conversations are about how you find a lot of ways for students, so at least you know what to put. So I mean, it's not here to get really get a real one, it's just something out of it right now, but at least we're taking time to get the conversation started. For my national assembly, I think that's probably the time job to have another job to make sure we're working with the community as well. So that is the top question.
All right. And before I acknowledge that, use the chair's discretion just to let you all know that I have no issues with the actual document, writing the document, but we will probably have to hold a special meeting before the end of the year. Like the one in December to get through all the rest of the agenda items. And I'm not saying that to deter you from voting for this. I'm just saying because there will also be normal attendance policies for that, and there's some really important stuff to pass to the SA. So, if you cannot tell by the thickness of this packet, probably every next meeting is going to be about this thick. So,
7 p.m. meetings.
7 p.m. meetings. So, with that, there's been a call to question, and I hope that we have cleared any ambiguity regarding commitment to the essay. So, we'll do a placard vote. If you are in favor of voting for Resolution 70, please raise your placards. 15. If you're against the resolution, please raise your placards. If you're abstaining, by a vote of 15-0-2, resolution 70 passes. Or some people have stepped out to get some water. Moving on to new business, resolution 69, making campus buildings accessible. If anybody who's in favor of this resolution would like to please step forward, whoever would like.
Hey, can you put this on the table over there?
Come on.
Nope, so not in order.
I'm Holly Shear and I'm a junior.
My name is Margaret Granoff and I'm also a junior.
My name is Scott Kim. I'm a freshman.
I did not know that. Actually, we're going to ask right now, is it possible for us to discuss 69 and 77? Since they're here and we have Kathy Fahey here also, and people have to leave.
Yeah, we'll recommend that. So you want to listen to both of these things?
Pretty much.
Right. So you want 69 and 77, right?
I can give them one more.
We have 6 minutes.
6 minutes. Great.
So take one and then you all can take your rest.
Okay. You want to start? Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
Basically,
we're proposing that a resolution should be made so that. Can you hear me? We're basically proposing a resolution so that clubs. Event planners would have to make their events accessible, have a baseline level of accessibility in order to apply for SAFC funding. And the reason for this is relatively simple. There are currently 850 students registered with Student Disability Services, and this number does not include people with temporary disabilities, such as people who are on crutches. So if you can imagine that you slip on the live slope on a winter day and broke your leg or something, and if you really, really wanted to attend an event that was happening on the fifth floor of a building without an elevator, like this one, then you can't attend that event. And this goes against the very motto of Cornell, the any person, any study. And the core idea behind that motto, I believe, is equal access. And if you cannot attend an event simply because of a disability, temporary or otherwise, then obviously that's not a very fair society. So I'm going to pass it now to Kelly. No, Michael.
Hello. I'm just going to explain what the resolution goes over. I won't read to you the resolution because it's in front of you, and I will not also read the disability checklist. But the resolution that we're proposing applies only to events on campus. This does not apply to events off campus or for a group meeting. This is, as I said, just events on campus. The addition is to section 9.3.2, for funding. And it includes an application to complete a statement of accessibility, which was produced by the Student Disability Services. Therefore, meaning that will not provide funding unless they provide, they have proof of they have a room reserved and the statement of accessibility. There's a document. With the statement of accessibility, it's a brief document of five bullet points of briefly stating that this event is accessible, ensuring that there's accommodation, a statement of accommodation on all advertisements, and there's multiple forms of advertisement so that there's a wide spectrum of Cornell students that are made available to these, are known of these events. And also just make sure simple things like an accessible restroom, an accessible entrance. We really strongly believe in this because the purpose of this is to raise awareness about disability and to also ensure that every student at Cornell has the equal opportunity to attend all events at Cornell.
Thank you. Okay. So, I'm Talia. As is evident from our list of co-sponsors, there's a diverse range of student organization leaders that are in support of this resolution. They strongly feel, as do we, that this resolution is not only mutually beneficial, but it's not unduly burdensome. The statement of accessibility should only take 5 minutes to complete, and the number of rooms available for events should not diminish significantly. So, we really don't anticipate clubs having any more difficulty than prior to this resolution in finding a venue to host their event. We have student organizers who have indicated to us that they truly feel bad when they find out too late that their events aren't accessible. So this resolution is a proactive approach to ensure that, to just minimize the potential of any club feeling embarrassed or uncomfortable that they can't provide access to their fellow Cornellians. And we understand that this may be viewed as a technicality or another obstacle that clubs must overcome in order to receive funding, but we would argue firstly that this should absolutely not be viewed as a technicality. We strongly believe that equal access should be viewed as an ethical necessity, and this is a win-win for everyone. So just in the sake of time, we believe this is a win-win resolution, and we strongly believe that obstacles should not be in place for individuals to attend events.
So we are going to move on to speakers here. Just so the FA knows, firstly, this is new business, quite bad, and it's a pretty good resolution. We are voting on a executive body resolution and an amendment to the FA guidelines.
This is geared towards I don't necessarily think there's been a huge problem with new construction. However, this basically was put in place to address a concern that was brought up in our own discussions about 77, is that a lot of this university is pretty old, 146 years old, and a lot of the older buildings, for instance, Rand Hall, the architecture studio, did not get an elevator until over the summer, and the ramp that's in front of there right now was just built for the sake of construction. So if a group, for instance, has an event in Rand Hall where equipment can't be moved because it's a workshop, what are they going to do? So the onus should not be on the student groups to make these buildings accessible, and the 77, again, does not require that groups move their event. It just has them think about this a bit more. This really just, it's encouraging the university, hey, prioritize any new construction project so that we're bringing older buildings up to ADA code or a comparable standard, since we're not really bound by the Constitution.
Okay. And I know you're talking to you about the problem in terms of the bottom line that you passed, not really, because you guys haven't been
able to meet with the issue that happened in the past. Absolutely. I actually discussed this with Joe Burke. We actually, in our Res Life meeting, this is where we drafted this one, that was a concern of his. You know, we talked about events in residence halls and events all over campus, so I'm going to continue to follow up on that.
So the accessibility checklist is the statement of accessibility, and that would be included as a link, you know, the same way a lot of other forms are.
So would the board be able to answer no to all the questions?
Yeah, so the checklist doesn't require that an event be accessible. So, you know, a big issue on the student assembly over the past year has been trying to broaden the venues for student groups to use in order to promote late night programming and other programming for mental health. This wouldn't limit that. But a lot of groups plan recurring events in places that aren't accessible without thinking about accessibility, like Cornell Minds Matters and other groups, which don't necessarily fill out this form. But if awareness is raised on campus, hopefully those events will be in, yeah, will be placed in more accessible locations because of that.
Thank you all. Next,
Representative Black actually asked a question this morning about it, and that's one question I should have. Is it a facility already on the UV one? So, is there any
Yes, the statement is on the UUP form currently, but there's no method for ensuring the accuracy of that statement. And it also is purely, it's one sentence long. So what this would do is at least require a little more thought being put into accessibility for events, but also we are hoping that eventually these statements can't, the checklist can be checked for accuracy via SDS. So it would actually require that.
And one thing that we were talking about in the Joint Assembly's Multicultural Issues Committee about this resolution was ultimately the goal should be to get something like this into the UUP and have that consistently enforced by SAO. We reached out to SAO. The problem is getting in the room with them at the same time. And then there's also concerns about whether they will think that that's a burden for them to implement or for student groups to fill out. So part of this is an interim measure. You know, if we can't get into UP now, at least we get it into something. And then the other aspect is this is leverage. You know, eventually you want this into the UP. If we don't have anything, then the ball's not rolling on this issue, then we have nothing to show for any of this. But if we have something going into that, then we can say, look, we already have this. We want to institutionalize this through you, not just through us. So help us out. And then in that case, you could almost do away with this because the UUP would have it in a much stronger way.
Next,
Hi, I was notified about this whole resolution a few days ago, and I do want to disclose that I have been a part of CUDA before. I am one of the students who's one of the 850 students who's registered through the Student Disability Services Office. I totally understand where this resolution is coming from. I think it's a really good idea in theory. However, by adding it to the guidelines, you're adding another piece of bureaucracy in terms of students applying for funding. And this might be the reason why an organization might not get funding for a local event if it's not widely publicized. And a lot of groups often say, you know, we get caught on these technicalities, and that's the reason why we don't get funding. And so it might appear to a lot of other organizations that the SA is, and the SASC is creating another obstacle for these organizations to overcome in order to acquire funding.
Do you mind? Yeah. And actually, Lauren and I had this conversation also. And I would just like to offer a lot. It just came up in our discussions a lot. When we talk about obstacle and exactly what is a burden really 5 extra minutes to think about the definition of accessibility and if your event actually is accessible to students? We have a job as a student assembly to make sure that we are representing all the students on campus. That doesn't mean just a few organizations who can, or individuals who can walk up and down the slope every day with no problems, who don't need to, you know, worry about establishing a disabilities plan and prioritizing walkways or making sure everything is cleared when they, you know, when snow is falling like no tomorrow. So it's going to come down when we vote to this. Do we value, you know, 5 extra minutes of filling out a form, or do we actually value those students and making sure they get to these events, they're able to get to these events? So that's my, go ahead. Yeah.
I'd also just like to add that as a president of a student organization, and as some of these, and you know, as you can see, a number of students have a number of presidents of student organizations have signed on to this resolution. A lot of groups actually want to think about accessibility, and a lot of them actually care a lot about it. And when you tell them, oh, this event wasn't accessible, or by the way, did you know that this event or this location isn't accessible, they suddenly, they say, you know, that's something I really care about, and I never thought about it that way. This piece of paper, which takes almost no time, to fill out, is a way to get students to take something that's already in their subconscious, that's something that they care about, and bring it forward and remind them, you know, in your planning of an event, if you care about accessibility, have you actually thought about it? One perfect example, which isn't actually affected by this is Cornell Minds Matters, which wants to improve student mental health on campus, but oftentimes holds recurring events in the loft in Willisbury Hall. Those events are not accessible. I bet you they don't know about that. And if you told them that they weren't accessible, I bet you they'd want to at least move those events every now and then outside of the straight to accommodate students with disabilities. And so I think that's kind of something we want to think about.
Just so you all know, we are not voting on this resolution this today. We're voting on next week. And I quote the speaker puts on the resolution. We have Representative Gard, Sai, Nick Letty, and Bajaj. First up, next up is Representative Gard.
I really do believe we're prepared for this resolution. It's trying to accomplish it. Not that this is the next accessibility mechanism would be a burden for groups, it's just for the groups that forget to do this one additional step. That's the only way I can see it being a burden because you are adding another process to the whole application. And I don't feel lenient in the local event general because you can continuously bring up Cornell Minds Matters, which does a lot of events, but what if they don't apply for funds? And this only goes to groups that do money. That's why it's a lot more better for a UUC instead of actually being put into the application. And because it really,
So this gets a bit technical, but there is actually no difference to doing this through the SASB or the UUP, except for the fact that we can do this. For our plan, we can do this through the SASB now and make sure it happens, or we can hope that SAO wants to do this on their own through the UUP. That's much less likely than us sitting here and saying, you know, we have the power to do something that positively affects this campus. Now, groups, when they hold a meeting, not an event, but a meeting, don't have to fill out a UUP. So essentially, this affects exactly the same thing that UUP would, except we can do it now, and we eventually want to see it on the UUP. This gives us leverage to do that. This gives us a framework to work off of with SAO, but the problem with just leaving it to SAO and the UUP is there's no certainty in that, and we have no control over it.
And follow up, have you actually had a discussion with SAFC about this?
With the SAFC?
Yeah, because you're talking about adding something. So have you had a formal discussion with them instead of just letting them know, hey, there's this resolution and do you want to actually make changes?
Right, so I'll get to see what this is.
Yeah, that's one of the reasons we're not voting on this today is because we want to actually have it presented to the SAFC G body. I did email Kevin and Lauren, which is why Lauren knows. I did email Lauren and Kevin about this, I'm expecting at some point we can actually sit down and meet with them as a G body, giving them time to forward it to them. They can read it over it in advance, and then we can actually sit down, which is why we're voting on this today. Yeah.
So again, just 30 years from this analysis and Laura's comments, I definitely think that there's merit to this resolution and what it's trying to accomplish, but I agree with that, that the UUP would be a much more suitable place to do it. And as you said, that it takes a couple of seconds to fill out. It also takes a couple of seconds to print out a Google map, but I think the SAC can attest to the fact that so many people get denied funding for small technicalities like that. I just think adding another form that people could possibly be denied funding for isn't the right way to go about this. You said that there's no difference between the UUP and the SAC edition, but I think there's a huge difference because it's not a new form. It's adding those to an existing form, and it's just put on it offline. And there's no one that would reach that year's purposes.
So I'll just... The thing with the Google Maps and why a lot of groups missed on that is that it's not in the guidelines. You know, when there's a form that's in the guidelines, unless a group is totally screwing up, which then they should be getting, ask Lauren, they shouldn't be getting funding anyway, groups miss the Google Doc because there is no, form that there's no link in there that they can click that takes them directly to what they need to do to submit that sort of thing. Would be, as all other forms are, linked directly from the guidelines, and assuming the treasurer or the president of the organization is doing their job, should be something that's very easy to find, easy to fill out, and I need to reiterate this, it's something that groups most groups, I would imagine, want to know about. It's just not things that they think about. And it's just
so I said that I think the conversation is about whether or not it's a good idea, but I think we've already
discussed it. Sure, so, sure.
For your information, section 11.2 of the SAC guidelines says,
I think he meant like an actual like link.
I said a link.
I think he meant a link, not
a link.
Yeah.
Point of information, to the chair, you know, so I was under the impression that not having this broad list here does have a process that has to check whether or not you're
in. Yeah, he said that. He said that 10 minutes ago. 15 actually.
I did want to mention that the GUPs actually are quite a different requirement from SAAC. That requirement that a lot of SAAC events are not subject to GUP requirements because they don't have so many people or they're not necessarily oriented to the whole public, like practices or even relatively small lectures that might not be covered by UNC, so this would be adding that requirement to the groups that don't have to deal with UNC.
Just to address this side quickly, I guess what I would ask is I do not think this should be viewed merely as a technicality, and furthermore, just like any other policy against discrimination, that's what this should be viewed as. And I guess what I feel like you should ask yourselves is, should clubs that don't provide access for all students on campus be given funding? Like, it shouldn't, this isn't, I don't think it should be viewed merely as a bureaucratic matter.
Quick addition. Right. I'm sorry.
I'm
sorry.
So, let me talk about the end of the little bit. We discussed this resolution and appropriated it in on Monday. But first off, I just want to say, I think we do agree with Resolution 69. I think everyone kind of agrees with the substance, the theory of what we're doing. First off, I know that you guys have a list of accessible, unaccessible buildings can't be public to, is that true about the list?
We will have it in the fall. Okay.
So that will be
on. It will be available in the fall.
Right.
And accessibility.
Go ahead.
Actually, also by July 1st, I'm Kathy Fahey from Student Disability Services. There will be an access map on from the front page, and that will have access elements to each building, so it would be really easy for someone to see what the accessible elements are to all of the buildings and path of travel and stuff like that. So I think this should be a much easier thing to do after that map goes live, and they have a deadline of July 1st.
So, commenting on that, I think that would be a better way to do this rather than putting the burden on student groups to have them figure out what's acceptable, and then once they figure it out, they can do whatever they want with it, and it keeps it themselves, because they necessarily have no other way of funding them. But besides that, talking about the increase, talking about the increase in bureaucracy, and you're going to hear the FAA guidelines that are reformed in a few minutes, hopefully. And that's about hopefully removing some bureaucracy, and I think if this puts it back in, this is going to become known as Google Maps global event. To talk specifically about your point, Matt, in the Twitter reports, which are directly linked to the guidelines and on the website, are clearly one of the reasons why groups forgot or didn't have their funding for this match. So I'm cautioned that this is going to be an issue. And I think also putting more information on a flyer, in addition to funded by Assembly Finance Commission or the NSA regulation right now, is going to be something. I think for something that doesn't actually provide any annual change, but it's more of an education method, I think it's inappropriate because we really shouldn't be attaching education to your funding. I think the idea is passing off the burden, of talking to accessibility services to educate students in other ways by putting on student groups in the SAC. So I don't think this is an appropriate use of our power.
I just want to remind everybody that we are not voting on today's section questions only.
Two thoughts.
And I'm going to go to Ari really quickly.
Oh, yeah.
Right, so I'll just read the section. It's on the second page, so you'd actually have to file a UUP to see
mischievous question, but accessibility. Please describe how you plan to accommodate guests who may require special assistance. And then in the sort of hint section under that, it says, consider parking issues, access to facilities, interpreters, etc.
All right. Thank you. Answer is 20 seconds.
Two thoughts. That's a lot.
Not a lot. 30.
All right. So one on the, this will be the Google Doc of the new guidelines. I just want to say, what do we feel is more important? A Google Doc, or that all students can access an event, which is in the SASB guidelines already. Right at the top of local events, it says local events should be accessible to all, it should be, all students should be able to attend local events. This is just enshrining that in a way that actually asks students to think about that. And my other point, you know, I just kind of want to follow up on what Ari was saying, is that, you know, this event, this document is not just a way, it's not meaningless. It really asks groups to think about something that they should be wanting to think about already, and many of them already want to think about, and it affects more groups than the UUP, and more events than the UUP. So I think it's not a nothing. It's not just something we can throw away. This is something tangible and substantive, and that was a minute, I think.
Again, try to keep time here because we have one more speaker. And this question is only related to the things we do. I have a question. I have a question. So, just off the point that you're listening to, every campus, in the end, we are here to represent every student, regardless of their accessibility, or sorry, their disability on campus, we're here to represent them. That said, we also represent the groups who make that point. I see an issue boiling down to the conflict of two issues. One, we have the issue of accessibility for all students, regardless of disability. On the other hand, we have the issue of bureaucracy, because the fact we've seen, I don't know how many, a record number of appeals of the SASB this year, and that's indicative that the guidelines are confusing to the public, that people are making mistakes. So, I mean, increasing the amount of bureaucracy will require groups to still have an effect. That said, we don't want to forget at the same time that one student that has enough a disability convert, one that also enjoys the exam. Because that's where the issue boils down. My question is, from what it seems like the essence of what you're trying to get at is an increase in awareness. You want groups to be aware that accessibility is something they should consider, as you said many times. So my question is, is there a better way that does not instill that much bureaucracy? It does not rely on a form that can be said no, yes, yes, whatever, or there's no enforcement mechanism. Is there a better way to increase awareness of the plight of these disabled students on campus that does not, you know, accompany, or it isn't accompanying broad bureaucracy? That's what I think we should conclude this off with, and that's something we should consider moving forward next week.
Hi, Kelly Donnelly, class of 2012. I didn't introduce myself at the beginning. We just wanted to say that the UUP is not checked for the accessibility statement, so people, when you're filling that out, its statement is not checked for accuracy or anything like that. Yes, while this checklist, accessibility checklist, will it raise awareness, we are hoping that it will be enforced. Kathy Fahey of Student Disability Services, Andrea, the ADA coordinator for facilities who works with SDS, will be looking at all of these checklists to make sure that they are enforced. Even if they can't be, even if all the events can't be held up to all of the standards, we're hoping that most of these standards can be met. And if they said for now that they think they can take this burden on, if they can't, they're going to be looking to hire a student employee, which they know they have the funding for. So going off of that, the disability accommodation statement that we're asking clubs to put onto their flyers is not just for physical accessibility. It's for producing large print brochures for events. It's for maybe having a captionist or a sign language interpreter if a student is deaf or hard of hearing. So we're not just looking at physical accessibility, but accessibility in many ways. Does that answer your question?
Can I add one thing? The motto at Cornell is any person, any study, not any group, any study. And so when we're looking out for the rights of students on campus, that's our primary goal, to protect students on campus, not to represent groups. Groups can represent themselves, as you see CUDA doing here today, but our responsibility is to the students. That's
so I'm going to reach out the watch and have 45 seconds
to
close
the
statement.
But I shouldn't do it.
I just need 10 seconds. I actually wanted to point out that the UUP form, the little sentence, is actually rather vague compared to our accessibility checklist. And I would imagine that many clubs would find it very confusing as to specifically how an accessibility is defined, and the accessibility form would kind of rectify that issue. And in closing statements, I suppose I would like to please consider this resolution seriously and represent the students who may or may not be able to enjoy all the activities that most of us do.
All right, thank you. That is the end of the discussion. We will revisit the discussion next week.
Thank you.
Just a second. I'm so happy. What the heck?
That's it.
I may need a little bit more than 4 minutes, but just to get through this PowerPoint. So, this, these SASC guideline changes conclude a year's worth of work. It was a campaign pledge of mine that hopefully I'll be able to fulfill by the end of the semester. So I have compiled a brief PowerPoint, or not so brief, and I hope that it helps clear things up and defines what we're doing concisely. So let's go ahead and start. Just so you know, looking on the first slide, the SASC guideline changes, so the document here with the proposed changes, incorporate what the Ad Hoc Review Committee submitted to this assembly last semester. First off, executive summary. Really quickly, the easiest way to summarize what we're doing is hopefully moving to year-long budget periods, opportunity in the spring semester to apply for a budget for the next year. So spring 2011, you could apply, well, how about this, spring 2012, you can apply for a budget for fall 2012, so two different academic years. Changes to the nature and timing of the allocation hearings, and that gets into being able to turn in documents that are missing or in that would prevent a group from being allocated funding, and then eliminate separate jointly organized events or what is also referred to as co-orgs. Year-long budget period. Eliminate mid-year reversion of funds so that unspent funds from the fall will remain available for organizations to spend in the spring. This change is actually a pretty major change. Usually what occurs or what has occurred in the past is at the end of the fall semester, all funds which were unspent reverted back to the SAFC, and then the organizations, if they, even if they still had funds at, in their budgets at the end of the fall, would have to reapply for funds in the spring. This past year, or this past semester, we had $170,000 worth of SAFC funds revert back. So in this system, that $170,000 worth of funds would have remained in the student group's accounts, and they wouldn't have had to reapply for funding. They could have only, but they would have had to follow the funding guidelines. Of course, they could only spend the funds that was left in their accounts on legitimate activities that the SAFC funds for. So, and then there are a few more, you know, descriptions on how it works. You know, so caps, that's going to be the largest issue which we're going to have to settle, not necessarily spell it out, enumerate it in the SAFC guidelines, but that's the trickiest issue. How much can we organize, how much can we allocate a group in the fall to ensure that we still have funds for all organizations who may want to still apply on a semester basis? And that could perhaps be done by maintaining, by looking at historical trends, how much were the total caps for this academic year, and say that will be the cap for next year. But that is still up for review, and that's probably the major contention that and the largest question mark within these changes. Two, opportunity in the spring to apply for a budget next year. That's pretty self-explanatory. The one point that isn't really enumerated here, if you apply in this budget period, so if you apply in the spring for the next fall or for the next entire school year, so you could apply at the end of next academic year, spring 2012, hit the cap and not ever have to submit another budget application. If you choose to use this budget deadline, and let's say that you make a mistake, let's say that you didn't account for something, you are not going to be able to apply in the fall of that academic year, simply because we cannot accommodate more groups applying for funds. More groups applying during the allocation cycle, simply because we already have 400 organizations who apply every semester, and we're at our limit here. So also, when you think about reverting funds, if we don't revert funds from the fall to the spring, we'll have hopefully fewer groups applying in the spring for funds, thus easing the pressure on the SAFC, the SA appeals process, and the office. Funding flowchart. So this is just a more visual representation. Funding periods, one allocation per academic year or one allocation per semester. So that's your choice. You, as a group, you can either apply for all your funds, hit the cap for the entire academic year, or you can apply once in the fall, which also includes the spring in the previous academic year, or once in the next spring. And then fall semester provides organizations for an opportunity to apply for funds. Spring semester provides an organization an opportunity to apply for funds. And then the next point as well, if we allow for a spring in the previous year deadline, we can allow the SAFC more time to process budgets in the fall, because organizations who want to put on an event right at the beginning of the semester can simply use the funding cycle from the spring, so that it eases a little bit on the pressures for the SAFC to get the budgets out, but also groups can have funding secured before the semester begins. Changes to nature and timing of the allocation hearings. Change the timing of the hearings so they occur after the commission releases a preliminary allocation. Allow organizations to present additional supporting documentation at the hearing for budget items already requested in order to ameliorate any deficiencies identified by the commission in its decision after rationale. So think inventory reports, reservations, etc. The one point that is not enumerated here is the hearings are no longer required for organizations unless they request it. So currently, even if an organization doesn't make any mistake on their budget, if they requested over a certain amount, then they're required to attend a hearing. Here, hearings would only be used for groups who simply want a hearing, or if they made a mistake on their application, and would like to turn in documentation. So that's, it's changing the purpose of a hearing. Yeah. Yeah, we'll be, I mean, we can go through specifically, but it should be in hearings. It's enumerated in the hearing section of the guidelines.
It's the new point 5.
Yeah. And then, this is a flowchart. I realize I'm taking a little bit of time here, but I really want for people to understand it. Funding supporting expenses, online application properly, completed property, complete supporting documentation properly, no hearing necessary, fully funded up to the cap. Online application completed properly, incomplete supporting documentation, essay if you communicates to group what documentation must be submitted during hearing or what is missing. Missing documentation can be turned at hearing and they get funded for that. If they don't turn in the documentation during the hearing, then they don't get funded. And then, of course, if they don't complete anything right, then they don't get funding. And then, so how this is going to occur for reviewing budgets, releasing out preliminary allocations, and then the groups requesting a hearing is still left up to the commission to specifically determine how they want to do that. However, we do have a few ideas which we can explain a little bit further if you all specifically want to hear about that. And then jointly organized events or co-orgs being eliminated. It's largely a paperwork issue as well as can be seen as a fairness issue as well. Simply for background, a co-org is an event that is essentially a way that two organizations can apply together for a separate category of funding to put on an event together. And in a way, they can apply for their own personal funding, receive the cap for that funding for their one group, and then they can create a co-organized event with another organization and receive the cap for co-organized events, and they do receive more funding on average than all the other organizations because they have two separate pools of money for their one specific event and then for their own personal expenses. So there is a fairness issue with that. And then two, I think was like only about 20 organizations applied for co-orgs, so it's not very burdensome on organizations. And that is where we're at right now. So, I will pass it off to my committee. First, Lauren, if you want to add anything specifically to this. I know that was a lot of information, but I'm done for now.
I don't have anything specific to add myself, because I feel like I've spoken up at our ad hoc meeting since August a whole lot about my opinions on it. However, we do have a fair share of commissioners who are here. So I want their point of view, and I believe that they're on the speakers list, so they'll be talking a little bit later.
Yeah, Ari. Actually, Ari's also been involved in this entire process, so is Terry.
Just one small factual clarification. Not that it's a huge point, but hearings are optional for all groups right now, but because they happen before allocations occur, a group generally feels pressured, especially if it has a large budget, to attend the hearing, whether or not the hearing actually will make a difference for their allocation. They don't know if the SAFC is going to have any concerns because they haven't received any feedback yet. The second thing is the jointly organized event application. You may notice that was not something that was in the report in December. Two major things influencing that is I've been getting rather continuous feedback from Terry Ector, who's the primary accounts person responsible for jointly organized events, that managing these separate events and accounts and process for just 20 organizations is very burdensome when it could be done as part of their regular budget. Plus, there are changes to university, not changes to university policy so much as changes in the way we have to implement that policy affecting independent organizations that would make it significantly more burdensome, almost to the point of not being practical to continue to create separate accounts and separate rules just for these co-org events that aren't really tied to a single organization. And I would be happy to talk more about the fairness issues, because I do think that there is a significant fairness issue in having the jointly organized events that also argues for finding a way to implement them through the regular SAFC budget process.
And then lastly, as requested by Resolution 7, we did request feedback from organizations, and we have a few letters of feedback that I'd like to pass out. Letters of support.
No letters of anger.
There's definitely a letter of anger.
But still support.
It was just supportive.
The comments were also emailed out to the
caps would actually be allocated on a yearly basis, not a semesterly basis. So it's up to the group, you know, like making up a number for a potential cap, and it's like $9,000, which is the sum of the fall district list for this year, but it won't be that high. But if they get a $9,000 allocation, if they want to spend all $9,000 the first week of school, that's up to them. I guess it's kind of like you guys, misconception about the thing. So it's not, you can't, it's not that you can apply for either an annual budget or a semester basis. Like, everyone will be doing an annual budget, and then you can add to it in the spring. So there won't be like, it won't be like some groups will have a yearly allocation and some will have a semester. Everyone has a yearly account that they can add to each semester.
I mean, that's one of the complications of moving from a semesterly funded basis to a year-long one, is we don't know exactly how to, like, figure out what the year-long cap should be. And so for the first few years, probably, there's going to be problems with modeling exactly where the cap should lie. Also, moving to a year-long budget is beneficial because, say, if you're on the softball team and you get funded in the spring and caps are traditionally lower in the spring than they are in the fall, it makes it a little bit more equitable for organizations to just apply for funding in the quote-unquote wrong semester. But it's definitely going to be difficult to figure out those caps in the beginning of stages.
So, can we get to the mic here? Something I want to add to that is, although I think it was more than 4 years ago, this is actually kind of a back-to-the-future change. Up until about 5 years ago, the SAFC always allowed organizations to apply on an annual basis in addition to the semesterly basis. This is basically that system, except that an organization doesn't have to choose.
Trying to combine our thoughts on this. I think that one of the proposals is to do two budget hearings a semester. I think that is a little daunting because there's going to be so much time spent on reviewing budgets. I know the rationale is that, you know, it's not like a group has a multiple opportunities to file, so the number of budgets coming in is going to be about even. However, there still is time that needs to be committed to going and setting up for budget hearings and whatnot and looking and reviewing those budgets prior to the hearings. And although you may not believe us, the commission does other things aside from budget hearings. We review guidelines and things like that. We do special projects. All that stuff takes time, and to figure out when to fit that into the schedule aside from doing budget hearings is going to be complicated. I also think that it's going to be very time-consuming to review budgets prior to hearings and to email each individual group to tell them what they did wrong so that they know what supplementary documentation to bring to the table. And I think another issue you run into is that by having commissioners review the budget and say, you know, these are the problems that you have, now come to the hearing and submit this documentation, you know, like, there is going to be human error, and if somebody reviews a budget, they might think that they've caught all the errors, but maybe they didn't catch an error, and they find that error at the budget hearing, and that might be grounds that that particular part of the budget doesn't get granted, and then that group might appeal to the SA and say, well, the SAFC should have caught my mistake.
Can you go to the overview page? Yeah, that's great. Alright, so I'll go through all four, I guess. The first one, I think it's nothing more than two semester budgets that we call a year long budget with the opportunity to get it again in spring. So I don't think that's a really huge change. Probably alright. Number two, I think that's the best change actually, because then student groups don't have to front the money for events at the beginning of the semester, which no one likes to do, and as we've seen this semester, it has caused some problems. Number four is number three is the one I actually have a lot of issue with, or many issues with. Basically because if you look at the time of to start, how we have it now is we have a health session, and then after that we have the budget hearing. And I think what's been lost in this is the actual value that is given in the budget hearing, where we get a lot of information from these groups about their budget and what information they have in it. And it can become very confusing when you look at just the wording in it and what they're actually getting and if that's a good event to have. And right now, is we advise them, then they submit it, and then they can appeal if they want. But with this change right here is basically we're saying that the first look that FAC has at the budget is the final look, and that's the one that actually matters, because that's where advising on them on what they should or should not give and giving an actual recommendation for them. And they're not there yet. So we can't ask them questions about their budget. We can't ask them whether or not, you know, this event is good or what is being funded here. And because of that, this first period where we recommend and then have the second budget here, I personally don't think it makes sense in the order of things.
Actually, can I respond to that real quick? Then?
Of course.
So I think hello. I just turned off. I think I also misrepresented number three when I described it. So the commission will allocate a preliminary allocation to the organization, let them know, and presumably the SAFC will only hold a hearing if the organization requests for a hearing to occur. And so if, let's say, an organization doesn't have all their documentation but doesn't request a hearing, or just simply take the lower allocation, then the SAFC doesn't necessarily have to do any more work. If the SAFC, you know, makes a mistake on a budget application, and again, the organization doesn't see it and simply doesn't request a hearing, then you know, the budget application would go through as it would this semester necessarily if an SAFC commission makes a mistake on the budget. And so the hearing would simply be allowed for an organization who responds, hey, can I have a hearing? Then the SAFC would presumably go out and say, you can have a hearing, this is why your budget wasn't approved, and if you would like to address these issues before you get to the hearing, then you're more than welcome to. But if you show up to the hearing without these things, then too bad, tough luck, you missed your second opportunity. So there wouldn't be necessarily this huge exchange, and that's not what we're calling for. And it actually doesn't necessarily change the system too much, in that there would simply be the second step in the process, which would occur anyways, because if the SAFC appeal to us, the SAFC still has to validate why they didn't get the appeal. So why don't we just do that step beforehand, and allow the organization to fill a budget, and also make the process more emblematic of what I think a student government is, which is supposed to be, help students out a little bit more, but, you know, if they miss the second budget application, then too bad.
Just to comment on the fact that help sessions and then hearings are the final say works. Appeals this year showed us that it doesn't work, because the majority of appeals were based on the fact that they did not submit a piece of documentation that they clearly simply forgot and not maliciously or, you know, otherwise didn't do. So this will allow us to tweak the process and actually help these groups that have had issues, which we've seen flesh and blood at this table.
All right, so just to make sure I have this whole process down right, or correct, rather. So a group submits their application for funding. Let's say they don't get the entire thing. They get a preliminary report back saying, you got this amount of funding, and then if they're unsatisfied with that, they can request a budget hearing. At that hearing, they can provide documentation that was omitted that is required, and if they submit the documentation, they receive the full funding.
Right.
Okay, so there's not an additional review of the budget after that. So it's right then and there.
Everything that's in excess of 200 and, or everything that's in excess of 2,500, the e-board re-reviews.
Okay. So in that case,
in the process that we have now.
Okay. So in that case, there's a preliminary application. So if it's over $2,500 in total, there's a preliminary review, a budget hearing if necessary, to provide additional documentation. And the e-board would review again.
Yeah.
And in that case, if they found an additional problem, the group would be screwed.
I mean, the group would have a problem, and they would probably file an appeal saying, well, the SAFC should have, found all my errors.
Okay, and that's something I guess we'll have to consider for the appeal process, because if the SAFC is not catching everything on the first go-around, if human error happens, but at the same time, you're kind of got screwed. And then I guess I'll just have one final question on that, which is, presumably, as Human Resolution 77 passes, that would be one of the aforementioned documents that a group could include if they forgot it, right?
Yep.
All right.
So, can I also just make a point that a process with more safeguards isn't necessarily a bad one, and if the commission does realize that it made a mistake, what's wrong with having, you know, another safeguard built into the system?
I support this, and I think walking through it, I am full support, and I'm actually glad that we're doing this, because if Resolution 77 is to pass, then an additional piece of paper won't actually be that big of a burden. If they forget it, they'll know to include it in the next go-round. I think that's a worthwhile point.
I think
that's not my
those two different separate issues. You're still feeding me. Yeah.
My question is, I think all these times already post changes are very valuable to talk with for on the issue of the brand application for the next year. When do groups receive notification about changes? Like, how is the mini budget hearing the possibly correct if the brand such that they would get allocation at the beginning of the fall? How do you work with this?
We have kind of addressed this, but not completely, because this is more of like a calendar issue than like something running into the actual guidelines. But we were thinking that we could hypothetically have groups go to this second budget hearing in the spring. They would get, commissioners would review it and whatnot, and then it would get passed on to Terry Echter. Because of how university funding works, they would probably get notified in the middle of the summer or at least by the beginning of the fall semester.
Okay, and then another question. Have you thought about having a deadline for the event in the fall? If you can't apply for the next year's funding cycle. I mean, the purpose of this is that the event is beginning on Monday, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So have you thought about having a deadline, all events, you can apply in the spring for the next year if your event is before September 1st or something like that?
I think
that you're incentivizing only groups. Because we don't want it to be another budget hearing for all groups in the spring for next year.
I mean, the groups either can apply in the spring or they can apply in the fall. There's not a deadline because if you want to get funding for something, say, in August,
yeah,
you need to file everything for that fall semester or everything for that entire academic year.
Okay. And then my final question, with this system with the spring application next year, wouldn't that make it very, very difficult to kind of hedge your guess for the full year allocation? Because you only have a little bit of information.
I want to follow up on that last question. It wouldn't be as difficult as you think if the allocations are actually released after the fiscal year ends, because by then the commission will know exactly how much money has reverted, and it'll have the same numbers that are available at the beginning of the fall semester.
But we won't know what the demand is,
yeah.
So that partially dictates where the cash lies.
Right.
Right now, we did 628 move that or in motion to extend the time to be because it's not on
half-time. Motion to extend by 15 minutes.
Second.
Instead of 15 more minutes. I also want to give more chance to the commissioners to speak. Can we just do one to one?
Yeah.
If you motion one to one. I think that's a really good comment. I think the one point which really needs to be emphasized here is that if an organization would like to do exactly what it's done for the past
3 years, it can do that in these changes. We are not changing from an organization's perspective. The only thing that they're going to really see change is the jointly organized events. Otherwise, pretty much everything else for them is going to be the exact same, unless, of course, they want to take advantage of some of the other options that we are providing them.
Something I want to add about the jointly organized events, because it's something that might not be immediately apparent about them. We're talking about 20 to 30 events that get somewhere between $60,000 and $100,000 each semester. That's up to roughly 20% of the funds that the commission gives out going to a very small number of events. Having them separated from a group's budget means that the group has no incentive to balance the cost in that event against their other priorities. And what we have observed is they end up meeting the groups requesting extremely high honorariums. The cap for honorariums under that category is $5,000, which is a lot. In most cases, an honorarium of $500 does the job. Those requests seem like they're out of line, and that there's a little bit of a perverse incentive for groups to be very liberal with their spending on a very small number of events that would not exist if they had to figure out how to make it work with the rest of their budget. And it would, I mean, $100,000 would actually have a significant effect on cash for all organizations.
And can I also jump in here? Regarding co-orgs, it's the co-orgs, creating a co-org with another group is similar to creating a brand new organization that has its own budget. And it's very easy for an organization to simply say, this is my budget, receive my budget for my own personal organization, and then I also want to put on this event, let me just find another organization that I can pair with, and then I can literally double my funding to put on this one event, and then I'll also be able to do all these other activities. And so there is a legitimate fairness issue here of why do some organizations, if they're able to simply call it a co-org, put on a separate event, and then receive much larger allocations, and it's only 20 organizations.
Just a single quick
400 apply recently.
Just, can I get a quick...
Yeah.
Ray, can I get like 5 seconds? Just, it's a fact.
Just move on. Just move on. You can ask me to give it next month. Next speaker.
All right. So, next one is Holden.
He had a prelim.
So, we want to recommend this guy.
So, things one core. I do it effectively, like why I want to take it away. But it does, in a sense, create unity, like on campus, it really promotes groups working together. But I have been a part of a situation where I just partnered up with other groups because I just. So, this is more to the FAP. When you ask questions during a hearing currently, like how does that play a part into the decision making? Like, what is the true purpose of the hearing?
I mean, we get to find out what the organization is all about. When it comes to actually like funding the organization, sometimes there is documentation that's confusing. And typically, if the group is there, they're there so they can clarify the documentation so that typically funding decisions go in their favor. If the group does not show up and there's a piece of documentation that's confusing, commissioners use their best judgment, but sometimes that doesn't end up playing in the group's favor. So I think they're beneficial in clarifying different pieces of documentation.
Can I give them my quick?
Yeah, I guess, Stav, I think both you and Jessica raised a good point that, like, while spending may be excessive, cohorts do serve a function. So I would ask the FA to think about if you want to eliminate cohorts altogether, if you think there's another alternative that isn't so onerous on groups. I think, Encore, you asked, like, how many groups there were. The 18 cohort organizations got, Adam, how much? 56,000?
I want to emphasize, there is no proposal here for preventing groups from jointly organizing events and applying for funds for the same event. It's just a matter of not separating that from the rest of their budget anymore, so that in a world of limited resources, they will decide, they will have an individual incentive to balance their expenses their other priorities, instead of sort of inflicting them on the greater and, what I'm looking for, less closely related student body.
So let's just say the proposed change is that the group wanted to apply together. Would each group get, let's just say the cap being 10,000 for the next fiscal year, one group get 1,000, another group get 1,000, and they have to use that budget together? Or are they just applying as a group saying, yeah, we're both applying and they're sharing that 1,000?
So they would have to apply first.
They would, basically they would both apply for the same event, but they would request either different expenses, or they would explain that, you know, only $2,000 of this is meant for our budget and the other 1,000 is going to a different group. But it would, I think the idea is usually they would split it up by the kind of event. Like one group applies for the sound, the other group applies for whatever.
So I'm another commissioner here to talk to you today about these changes and, you know, kind of the feeling of the commission and how we see it as really a problem of implementability and a problem of just getting stuff done. At the end of the day, I think the core problem to these changes, especially three, is that they aren't feasible and they're not actually enabling more groups to get more funding. I think at the point of SAFC fundamentally is to enable groups to get the funding they need to go and do the things that they want to do, to make Cornell a better place by not making funding a problem, right?
Why isn't it feasible?
Why isn't it feasible? Because when you look at, if you look at how we currently allocate for an entire semester or an entire year, it's based on a model that's in itself, you know, somewhat flawed, in that it's assuming that things are going to stay constant year to year, there's going to be linear growth. But as we've seen, it's more like exponential growth. And that's not something that you can posit or that you can guesstimate. I think the best way to describe it is that we're in uncharted territory without a compass. You can't have no understanding of how we can model out caps for a year or semester just based on like all sorts of changes to our funding guidelines. Second, I really want to focus on number four, eliminating jointly organized budgets. I think that, you know, though obviously this has become a very large portion of the allocation table, fundamentally core budgets and co-organized events provide a really great service to Cornell. And I think that we can't overlook the fact that, you know, we've all probably thought about or have gone to a co-organized event. Things that couldn't exist with the ability to have jointly organized budgets, i.e. duck ball or agent. These things, you know, even if you tried to divide money among the involved parties, all it would do is decrease the amount of local events on the Cornell campus that could legitimately be implemented, and I think that's something that we should be wary of. At the end of the day, I think that we should really think about how we can implement these things over time rather than asking for all the change to happen at once, which is simply not feasible.
So, and I say this with the utmost respect, but I think that the feasibility aspect, the argument that was put forth, had nothing to do with the actual allocation of funds. It was this issue of, if we allow groups to complete their budget application, more groups will be funded, thus overall groups will have less money in their bank accounts. And I don't think that is the sentiment nor the purpose of the SAFC nor the Student Assembly to create restrictions and bureaucracy just so that fewer groups can receive money, so that fewer organizations get a greater a dollar amount. And if we do want to address that issue, this assembly can do that through the byline funding process and allocate more money to the SAFC. But from and I understand that there are going to be changes and there's still unknowns, but I think one of the largest is that there still hasn't really been a very strong argument against why changing the funding procedure, I'd love to hear more, but we've been talking about it for a year and we still haven't heard a strong argument for why change number three is not, we are not able to implement change number three. So.
I just wanted to say quickly, I totally understand the concerns that I think the commissioners will raise about having so many things changed at once, but all of these changes were carefully thought over from the perspective of how do we make it easier for everyone involved, for the SAFC, for the organizations, for the SA, and for our staff. And, you know, any change is going to be spooky to everybody because it leaves a lot of unknowns. You know, exactly when are these hearings going to happen now? And we know that we don't have all the answers for that, but we have made it a point only to include in this proposal things that we think will significantly reduce the burden for everyone.
Thank you.
I mean, one of the things that we did bring up is the fact that I think if all these changes are going to go into place, they need to do so gradually. And so one of the agreements that the ad hoc committee came to last week was that we would go to two budget hearings a semester in the spring and not in the fall, so that we can get adjusted to this whole, like, reviewing budgets before hearings thing, because I think if it's one fell swoop, it's going to be a little much. I also think that one thing you should consider that Vince brought up is, yes, more groups are going to get funded, and their caps are going to be lower, and because groups are going to get a second chance to, like, fix their budget so they can get, quote-unquote, fully funded, that makes it, there's less of an incentive for groups to do their budgets the correct way in the first place. Yes, if they do their budgets correctly in the first place, they won't have to go to a hearing and they'll know that they're going to get fully funded, you know, maybe a week ahead of time. But ultimately, I think students tend to leave things to the last minute, and they're basically going to be asking the SAFC to give them a checklist of even more things that they have wrong with their budgets. And I think that the burden is, in fact, going to increase on the SAFC, although it will take the burden away from other organizations that are involved with this.
Thank you. With that, time is now 6:45.
She's been waiting for, like, forever.
Just
been for 2 minutes.
Just until she's done. How about that?
No one else. Be nice to our audience.
Second.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to add on to what Bangu was saying before about number three. I think, like, it doesn't really even seem that necessary of a change. Like, it's almost like, maybe I'm harsh in saying this, but, like, it's almost addressing the fact that, like, group treasurers will make mistakes in their budget applications, or, like, will read the guidance carefully enough to submit, like, proper documentation. And so, like, essentially addressing that issue is going to make a completely, like, less efficient process, because, like, first of all, like, groups are, like, well, first of all, like, the treasurers won't necessarily have an incentive to make their budget application, like, exactly perfect the first time, because they know that they'll just have a second option to submit documentation, and they know that, like, no matter what, they'll be able to have, like, another opportunity to submit more stuff, so, like, they're not going to be even, like, that incentivized to make their budget application perfect. And then with the commissioners, like, their first, like, preliminary allocation decision isn't going to be the final say. So, like, what's saying, like, of course, like, in a perfect world, we would try very hard to have that allocation, like, be perfect and not make mistakes, but, like, the fact that we're just, we know, like, they're going to have another opportunity to submit stuff anyway, and it's not, like, the final decision, it kind of means that, like, we're not really, like, that motivated to completely, like, make the final decision perfect to begin with, and it's, like, just going to make more time because, like, if we're going to review the application, then they're going to be able to submit more documentation, then we're going to review it again, plus the time commitment of having to tell groups what they're missing the first time. It just, like, seems a lot less efficient to me.
Okay, real quickly, and as a club president, I have to wholeheartedly disagree. I think
what is your motivation?
Timing of the allocation
to get it funded.
Because, you know, I've been there at budget hearings where the three kids in front of you said, well, everything looks good, we have no more questions. And then 2 days later, you find out, well, when you reviewed it as a committee, it got rejected. So I do think that that can do a lot to help people by changing the nature of the hearings, which is far larger debate. What I want is that since all these SASC members are coming at it with different angles, which really sounds vague, like the debate really could be a lot shorter if we had some kind of, you know, memo from the SASC as a whole laying out which point they disagree with and why, instead of having all these, this bigger, well, this is too big, I don't like that part's okay. I mean, to really clarify the debate so we can move on to the lot, I think that, you know, some kind of documentation memo from the SFC to clarify your point of view would be helpful.
Turn in your SAFC packets.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.